I'm James Murray, University of Oxford, part of the Oxford Bristol Nuclear Research Centre. My pleasure to introduce the first speaker, Martin O'Brien from CCFE. Over to you, Martin.
Okay, thank you. A bit of change, maybe onto fusion now. So CCFE is Cullum Centre for Fusion Energy, for those of you who don't know. And as it says in small print, which you won't be able to read at the bottom, CCFE is a fusion research arm of the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. As probably almost everyone in the room knows, the UK Atomic Energy Authority over the years, most of it has gone to the four winds and is just left with essentially fusion research now. Having said that, and one of the reasons for fusion surviving, I think, is very much its international context, and I'll be covering that in this talk. But having said that, as fusion is developing more to the materials and technology phase of its development, and I'll mention that later, we're getting more overlaps with the rest of the nuclear world, both the fission energy and other aspects of nuclear. So in some sense, we hope, we're sort of coming full circle and that we're making more links with fission research, both in universities, people like NNL, et cetera. So with that sort of introduction about the organisation, I'll get on to the talk. I expect most people here know about this, but very briefly, fusion is what goes on at the middle of the stars, including the sun, the aim is to harness this energy on Earth. But how the hell do you do it? We haven't got something the size of the sun. We've got to do it on a sort of the scale of everyday scale. And the way we at Cullum do it is through magnetic fields, trying to keep a very, very hot gas, which in that temperature that we need, 150 million, is fully ionized and therefore a plasma, away from the walls. And we use a magnetic bottle to do that, and the particular design of magnetic bottle that's most successful is called a tokamak, and that's just a schematic on the top right. There is another approach to fusion, which is based on using lasers to compress and do mini sort of explosions. I'm not going to talk about that at all, but if it does come up later, that we do have Chris Edwards from AWN and the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory who can comment on that. As I'll say later, actually, as both inertial and magnetic fusion get more developed, they're converging again in some ways with some of the on the materials and technology, because some of the needs are common. So why is fusion taking so long? It's very, very difficult. So what are some of the challenges? So the basic reaction, the easiest reaction to do is deuterium plus tritium giving neutrons plus alpha particles, helium nuclei. Then helium stays in the magnetic bottle because it's charged, but the neutron flies out. The helium comes off with 3.5 MeV, so keeps the plasma hot, whereas the neutron, being neutral, flies off and is absorbed in a blanket which surrounds this reacting plasma. And that blanket has two functions. One is to capture the heat from the neutron to eventually generate electricity, but also to generate the tritium that you need to fuel the reactor. The deuterium is easy to get from seawater, but tritium has to be generated from the neutrons hitting lithium in the blanket and producing the tritium. And we're now moving to this phase of a lot of the technology, and one of the key technologies is the blanket, which has many aspects, both this production of tritium, but also how you have make it out of materials can withstand neutrons for many years. And I'll touch on that a bit later. So this is Cullum in Oxfordshire. There are two fusion programs on site. One is JET, which is the Joint European Torus, which is, it doesn't look like this if you go in there, and it's surrounded by heating systems and measuring instruments, etc. And this side of the site, this eastern side, was all developed late 70s, early 80s as a European project. And there's also a UK program on the west side of the site, and that is our experiment MAST, which is looking at a more compact way of doing magnetic fusion. I think David Kingham will touch on it or cover this in his talk. I should say, as this is partly a sort of policy meeting, that I think the reason fusion survived in the authority, whereas the rest of the research didn't, is largely down to JET, and there was these international connections, which I'll come onto in the next slide. So what do we do in the UK program, which is sort of a microcosm in the sense of the world program. There's the fusion experiments on the plasma, how to optimize the plasma, etc. And I think Howard Wilson will talk about some of these aspects later. There's theory of modeling, which is my particular area, both of the plasmas, but increasingly of the materials that surround it. And we work a lot with Oxford, who are the experimentalists. We provide the models, etc., for example, on the effects of neutrons on the steels and other material that surrounds the plasma. And materials and technology, this is very much increasing at Cullum and increasing the European program and worldwide as we move there's a gradual shift maybe from the emphasis being mainly on the plasma to more about power plant systems. So this is JET. It's about, I suppose, 3 or 4 meters, nearly 4 meters from the bottom to the top of the vessel. As I said, a European project. We, the Atomic Energy Authority at Cullum, operate the machine. We're paid to do it by the rest of Europe, and we have teams of typically 100 European scientists who come at any one time to do experiments. But you don't get a Portuguese experiment, a Romanian experiment, or whatever. They're in two or three task forces, and they're all very multinational. And we provide our own UK scientists to that as well. I should say, by the way, I meant to mention this on the previous view graph, that we have many links with universities, and some of them include involvement. For example, so Howard has students from York are involved in experiments on JET. One of the biggest change to JET over recent years is they've changed totally the inside of the vessel. It used to be carbon clad, and the problem with carbon was that it eroded, you got dust, and it absorbed tritium. And in a future machine, a power plant, that just would be unacceptable because the tritium inventory will build up and up and up. So carbon has now been changed to metal, and that is a combination there of beryllium and tungsten. And the beryllium and tungsten as the liner will be what's used on the next machine, ITER, which is I'll come on to in a minute. And ultimately in a power station, probably tungsten is the most likely liner for the machine, because it can take very high power loads with minimal erosion and things, so the erosion doesn't pollute the plasma too much. And anyway, so the focus of the JET experiments are moving now more to materials, in particular plasma-materials interactions. JET is the only machine that can use tritium now. There used to be a machine in America, but that shut down in 96. So it's the only machine which in fusion really is nuclear. Most of the time we don't use tritium, because we don't need to, because the plasma behaves largely the same with deuterium and tritium, not exactly, but largely. But we have developed at JET this capability to use tritium and things that go with it, like remote handling. And those will be essential integral features of any future machines, because there's no way you can send men into JET, but we don't nowadays. All the changes of the tiles, the thousands of tiles, were done by remote handling. Future machines, it will just be impossible because the radiation would be too much. The performance so far of JET is about the fusion power out is almost the fusion power in, the heating power in, and we're very confident that, you know, we know what to do to get much more power out than in, and that's to make it bigger and stronger fields, stronger magnetic fields. Just to sort of linger a bit on the benefits to the UK of an international project like this, I think it's the only big European or international science project in the UK. The UK puts in maybe 15, maybe up to 20% of the funding, but almost all the money comes back to the UK. And we've built up a lot of expertise at Cullum, both in the plasma disciplines, but also some of the nuclear disciplines, the tritium, the remote handling, largely at European expense. This isn't something we emphasise when we talk to European audiences, because they're always saying UK should pay more. But we resist that. So it is very a very good deal for the UK. Over 2/3 of Cullum's income comes from the rest of Europe and the rest from EPSRC. But I think one message is if in the other areas of nuclear or international projects, getting involved in those is a protection from government quick decisions to reduce you, and is also, if you can actually host one, is tends to be a very good deal. And we see this in other areas of science where, for example, France hosts neutron facilities, etc. I think they get a good deal. And I think they'll get a good deal in the next machine, which is called ITER, which is this thing which is being built in France. And this is now not European. It's got 7 partners, of which Europe is just one. Their flags are down there. It's got well over half the population of the world represented in those countries. So the aim of ITER is to demonstrate a lot of the fusion power station technologies on a power station scale. And the aim is to get at least half a gigawatt of fusion power out. This isn't for electricity, but this is there won't be electricity generation, but to demonstrate power station sort of scale powers out for much, much less heating power in. And there's a lot of confidence based on our plasma understanding that we'll do at least as well as that. And to do it for length scales that are now significant, to use superconducting coils, that means that unlike jet, where the copper coils get hot and you've just got to turn it off, you can just keep running the plasma. And the key technologies in particular, it will test as well as these superconducting coils and these remote handling techniques to change things inside, are the blanket. There will be test blankets to demonstrate tritium generation and generate and demonstrate that the blankets get hot enough for power conversion. And also something called the diverter, which is right at the bottom, which is where the exhaust power from the plasma comes. And this is probably the most challenging technical area, because it's not clear that we yet have a design that can withstand the high heat fluxes that will come out. And in particular, I think this is one of the challenges for the plasma physics, to reduce the exhaust power. Now, ITER's made the headlines for some of the wrong reasons over the last few years. Its original price tag was less than half what it is now. I put order £10 billion there, which I think is about right. The aim is starting first plasma, but a pretty token plasma in 2020, and to use actual tritium fuel in the middle of that decade. And now, just as a message here, that part of ITER's problems, a lot of them have been sort of politically driven, not deliberately, of course. The way this is being procured is not the way you procure a big, high-tech, very challenging, difficult project. So 10% of the budget is held by the central team in France, and the remaining 90% is procured by 7 agencies around the world. And Europe's agency isn't even in France, it's in Barcelona. That just gives you an indication. And you have all these interfaces, but not only just between components, but between different procurement teams all around the world. So it's very complicated, and that was driven very much by the politics of this. The Japanese in particular were very concerned that if it was all just down to a central budget, their industry wouldn't get enough of the share, so they insisted on this sort of in-kind way of doing procurement, which has been a problem, so it's something to avoid. Having said that, I think whatever will happen, the host nation, France, will benefit disproportionately, just, you know, if only through income to the local economy. So what about after ITER? Well, in the latter stages of ITER, the plan is demonstration power plants will be built, probably all separately around the world, because I don't think there'll be many international partnerships there. The Koreans and Chinese are the most aggressive, and with plans to go straight to a demonstration power station. The European approach is embarking on a conceptual design and very much doing all the research before you actually get on with the actual building. The Koreans and the Chinese are more gung-ho and are much more, let's build it and see what the problems are. So I think it's likely that the Far East will steal a march and get the first one built, etc. Quite whether in the long run that's the best tactic remains to be seen. But I'm afraid we're still talking about the order 2040 for electricity generation because of all these technology challenges. So what's the status of the research? Firstly, on the plasma, and some of my plasma physicist colleagues would disagree with this, but it would be interesting to hear what Howard's got to say. I would say the plasma understanding is very well developed, but there's a lot of room for improvement to make the plasma smaller, to get power out with a smaller plasma, to minimize this exhaust power that's so difficult to handle, and to avoid dangerous instabilities, which can also damage components that surround the plasma. The materials and technology, on the other hand, is another matter. There are several promising candidates, but some of the promising candidates might have very good properties, but how do you make them in bulk, or vice versa? Things that can be made in bulk, they have problems. And this is where there's lots of overlap with fission, in particular on steels, as I think I'll come on to in the next slide. One thing that there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem with fusion is that it produces neutrons that are much more energetic than fission. Its neutrons that come at 14 MeV, whereas fission systems tend to be MeV or less, and so we don't have high flux, high power neutron sources at that, and there is a proposal to do an international test facility of 14 MeV accelerator based, but that's pretty challenging, and quite when that will happen I don't know. But there's clearly a need for test facilities on both macro and micro scale, and I'll come back to the micro scale at the end. Technologies, you could have several talks on the status of that, and some of the technologies are well developed, others require testing on ITER, etc. The key issue, of course, ultimately for any system will be reliability and maintenance, because that will dictate the economics of the power station. And there's a lot more work needs doing on that front. And this is just a reminder of what I said earlier on, that some of these, this is where maybe inertial fusion and magnetic fusion will start to converge more in their research programs, and there's already in the UK moves to do this, particularly on materials and technologies, because the plasmas are very different. So this is just ramming home the point that there are some research overlaps between fusion and fission. This is actually an American graph showing for steels, how the neutron damage against the operating temperature, how that varies for different systems. And you can see there's a lot of overlap, and we're using, we're therefore considering the same material science. Other areas where we get involved a lot with our fission colleagues are neutronics and nuclear data. And this isn't just energy. There are other applications for the codes that have been developed in fusion, because we have very good nuclear data, for example, in homeland security and things like that. And some of the technologies are common as well. I'm going to finish on this slide because it's very topical. And one thing that's not been mentioned today is that today there is a press conference, I think, launching or giving the results of a government review of nuclear R&D chaired by Sir John Beddington, the outgoing government chief scientist. That will include mention of a new national nuclear users facility, £15 million for it, and actually there's a sentence on it in today's Times, which to Chris Grosvenor's disgust is the English was appalling, but anyway. I can show you that later if you're interested. But anyway, this is to provide some funding, three ways, for some funding for a new facility at Culham, one at NNL and one at Dalton Cumbria, or rather upgrades to the Dalton Cumbria one. And what we're doing at Culham is we'll provide a facility for universities and others to use where we can take radioactive material that's mildly active, far more active than you could take at a university, and we will be cutting up samples, which might be the size of your thumb, into these microscale samples. And illustrated here is the work they do at Oxford on micromechanics, where this is a little cantilever that's a few microns long. And they do, you can look at stress strain and other mechanical properties on irradiated and unirradiated material. Now, Oxford done a lot of this work so far on material that's been damaged by ion beams, but not neutrons. And this will now allow us to do it on neutrons. So this is very topical, as I say, it's been announced today. And as is the way of these things, we knew about this a while ago, and we were told, if we give you some of the money, can you spend it by the end of the March? which we have. We did factory acceptance tests last week, and hopefully the equipment will start arriving next week, just into April, etc. But we've just about managed that. But anyway, at least it's a sign things are turning on nuclear research in this country. There is new money and a new emphasis in government and research councils to fund research of this nature, and I thought that would be a good place to end.
We'll take the questioning at the end, so if we can move on to our next speaker, which is David Kingham from Tokamak Solutions, who will tell us a different story about fusion, I think.
Okay. Is this okay? Everybody hear me? Good. Good morning, everybody. I'm going to continue the theme of magnetic fusion, magnetic confinement fusion. And I'm going to talk particularly about small spherical tokamaks and their potential role in the development of fusion power. So this is taking a technology where Culham really has the world lead and looking at what might be done on a relatively small scale with relatively small devices in a way that should be quite complementary to what can be done with these huge devices such as JET and ITER. So Tokamak Solutions UK Limited is a private company. It was established to try to make fusion useful quickly, particularly by developing these spherical tokamaks and also by developing the concept of a fusion neutron source. And indeed, we've completed the conceptual design of a fusion neutron source capable of producing 14 MeV neutrons based on a small spherical tokamak. And that could be an interesting candidate for a way of producing a decent output of 14 MeV neutrons, which could be useful both in fusion research and indeed in fission materials research. So the business is based at Culham in the Innovation Centre, so it has advantages of proximity to world-leading research. And of course, the UK's flagship fusion program at the moment is MAST, the Mega Amp Spherical Tokamak. And that originated from a tokamak called START, the small tight aspect ratio tokamak. And a picture of the plasma in START is shown here. And it's quite a compact device, so the plasma diameter, something less than 1.5 meters. The remarkable thing about START was that it set world record, a world record for plasma pressure, normalized plasma pressure. You want the magnetic field to be as efficient as possible at confining a plasma, and START set a record in that respect, which it set the record in the mid-90s, and the record still stands today. And that gives a hint as to why these spherical tokamaks with a very tight aspect ratio can be interesting devices. But they do have a challenge in that you've got to get a huge current down the centre column of the tokamak. Now, recent breakthroughs in the manufacturing of high-temperature superconductors have an interesting effect. Potentially, these high-temperature superconductors can conduct very high currents in a high magnetic field, and that gives us a possible way of achieving a high magnetic field in a small spherical tokamak. This is something we're working on at the moment. And we think that such devices could help accelerate the development of fusion energy. There are some things you can do in small devices relatively quickly and cheaply, which could have important impacts for larger devices. A few facts here about fusion power. I think Martin's covered several of these already. There are the two main candidates, magnetic or inertial confinement. I think it's right to say at the moment magnetic confinement is the most promising. It's certainly the best proven as things stand. And there are several variants, stellarators, spheromaks, tokamaks. And as things stand, tokamaks have by far the best performance, particularly the JET tokamak at Culham. As Martin said, the fuel is deuterium and lithium. It's cheap and plentiful. And the world's main emphasis in fusion research is in working with this huge new device in France called ITER, which does run the risk from the UK's perspective of being in the world lead at the moment in fusion research, but as things move towards potentially the commercial application of fusion, perhaps is a risk that the UK would lose its world lead. So that, I think there's an important policy implication there. it's one of the few areas, fusion is one of the few areas where we do have a very distinctive world lead. And also it's an area where it's pretty sure that it's going to be of huge economic importance in 50 years' time, perhaps a bit sooner than that. It'd be a shame to lose the lead at the wrong moment. So the reason we're excited about spherical tokamaks is actually they can be relatively small, relatively straightforward to build. We've managed to build one in our own laboratory as a private company. They're reasonably close to the mainstream, the more conventional aspect ratio tokamaks, but they're distinctive enough to allow development of proprietary technology. It's clearly important for a company to be developing things that it can own. But also the results of plasma research on a spherical tokamak can be relevant to larger devices. Another important aspect is that spherical tokamaks use, because of their configuration, they use the magnetic field more efficiently than a conventional tokamak. The ions in the plasma spend more of their time in a high magnetic, in the highest magnetic field region of the device. And this is one of the reasons that led to the world record plasma pressure being set in a spherical tokamak. So the thought is, if only it was possible to achieve a high magnetic field in a small spherical tokamak, wouldn't that be an interesting device for pushing the limits of plasma physics and fusion research? And basically, because of these new high-temperature superconducting materials, we think there's a decent chance of being able to achieve high field of the order of 5 Tesla in a relatively small spherical tokamak. So this slide here gives a schematic of the high-temperature superconducting material that we're using at the moment. It's a multi-layer structure with a Hastelloy backbone, copper coating on the outside. The tape itself that we're using is 100 microns thick, and only 1 micron of that is the high-temperature superconductor. So the current density within the superconductor itself is huge. And the interesting property of the high-temperature superconductor is that it can withstand a very high field. So the graph here is a field from 0 to 30 Tesla, temperature range from 0 to 100, and the conventional low-temperature superconductors are fine at liquid helium temperatures and at magnetic fields up to 15, 20 Tesla. Well, they're giving up at about 20 Tesla. But right over on the right-hand side is the yttrium barium copper oxide material we're keen to use, which, first of all, can be a superconductor above liquid nitrogen temperature. But the really interesting thing is if you cool it down to 20 Kelvin or perhaps even to helium, liquid helium temperatures, it will take a very high current in a very high field. And this is a different plot illustrating much the same point, that it has a remarkably high critical current at high field and low temperature. So on this plot, it's critical current on a log scale against magnetic field in Tesla. And if you look at the 5 Tesla field, as you go from 77 Kelvin to around 20 Kelvin, you can pass 100 times more current in the material. Now, we have high hopes for the improvement of this material over the next few years. It's gone from R&D into manufacture in the last few years. There are 4 competitive manufacturers around the world. They are all predicting significant improvements in the material. And through a mixture of process innovation and competition, we should see significant improvements in the material. So that sets the scene. What are we actually doing? well, we thought, once we got confident that this material was usable, we talked to Oxford Instruments, and 3 years ago they said, wouldn't touch it, it's not very reliable. And 2 years ago they said, looks promising now, let's have a go. So one of my colleagues managed to persuade people in Prague that we could borrow their tokamak and fit poloidal field coils onto an existing tokamak using this high-temperature superconductor. So this was quite a string and sealing wax, sort of bold, let's have a go at it, see if it works, experiment, involving a plywood cryostat, hand-winding a magnet on site, and assuring the people that we weren't damaging their nice tokamak while we were doing it. But actually, it worked out absolutely fine. We learnt lots of things about connectors and winding these magnets rather quickly. And the tokamak works happily today, still using these high-temperature superconducting magnets. So the next step is for us to build our own tokamak and to take on a bigger challenge of going to higher performance magnets, still fairly modest, but a bit higher performance, but also to have not just the poloidal field coils, which are relatively simple, but also the toroidal field coils to complete the magnetic bottle using high-temperature superconducting magnets. So that's what the tokamak looks like at the moment. So there is a third tokamak at Cullum in the Innovation Centre at the moment. It does work. We do allow people to come and see it if they particularly want to. But that just has copper coils on at the moment. We have done remote demonstrations of it. It will achieve plasma temperatures of 1,000,000 degrees, somewhat short of the 150 million required for fusion, but it's a nice device. It sits on a table much smaller than the tables you're all sitting at the moment. And we can get plasma pulses of a couple of seconds long. And what we're now doing is designing and building the high-temperature superconducting magnets to go on to that tokamak. They've been designed by ourselves and Oxford Instruments, and Oxford Instruments are just building the magnets at the moment. The high-temperature superconducting material is very compact, so you've actually got quite large cryostats to keep it cool. The amount of material in there is tiny. It's for the poloidal field coils, it's 23 turns of a material that's 100 microns thick. So it's very nice and compact. The material is fairly expensive at the moment. Material for this has cost us around $100,000, but the price performance of the material is going to change remarkably, dramatically over the next 4 or 5 years. So, to sum up, we think that small spherical tokamaks can be built relatively easily and cheaply. Well, we know they can because we've done so. They're exciting because they use the magnetic field very efficiently. It now looks possible to design and build these devices with surprisingly high magnetic fields, something that's not looked possible in the past. And we think that a whole range of interesting experiments could be done in these devices and done relatively quickly and cheaply, and that this could help to accelerate the development of fusion energy. Thank you.
We'll pick up the questions at the end. So our next speaker is Andrew Hughes from Rolls-Royce, who we're talking about small reactors, and particularly, will the UK be found napping? So we're taking a slight change in technology, but still small.
Hiya. I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank UK Pony, the NRC and the Cabot Institute for inviting Rolls-Royce here to speak today before I start. Okay, so will the UK be found napping small reactors? For the purpose of this presentation, when I talk about SMRs, I'm going to be talking small modular reactors rather than small medium. So I'm going to be talking about the IAEA definition of small, so less than 300 megawatts. But that's not to say that you can't cluster these together into sites to have gigawatts of powers. So first of all, I'd just like to start by saying that small reactors are nothing new. All reactors prior to 1970 would fit into the small or medium bracket. And in fact, the first, what we class as a large reactor nowadays, didn't really come into existence until 1970. There's over 120 operational SMRs around the world, and that's spanned across 25 countries. So why this change from small to larger? Basically, it's the historic approach to reducing nuclear costs. It was the idea of increasing power density. So the graph at the bottom shows since about 1976, the average reactor power in a year has been in that large bracket. But creating larger and larger plants has created larger and larger components, larger and larger forgings, which is basically, we're now in a position where there's only a handful of facilities within the world which are capable of producing some of the forgings needed for things like the EPR and the AP1000. What's strange about this phenomenon of getting bigger and bigger and bigger is the fact that most other industries have reduced the engineering costs by simplification and volume of production. And this is kind of what the small reactor is trying to aim for and what it's trying to look at. So the old approach of this economy is a scale, changing power down to this idea of economy of volume. But, as the graph on the bottom shows, this is being done against a background of decreasing reactor sales. As you can see, the peak in reactor sales was in about 1980, in the mid-1980s. So, SMRs use this argument, but why is there this reduction in sales? Claire Durkin yesterday raised the point that there's no economic growth without power. And that's true, but there's a huge energy demand in the world today, not only to maintain current levels, but also to support growth in the future. If you look around the globe, 70% of America's existing generating capacity needs replacing by 2030. And then on top of that, you've also got their growth needs, 25 gigawatts by 2035. Europe's no different. 30% of Europe's generating capacity needs replacing by 2030. And 33% of the UK's generating capacity needs replacing by 2025. So there's a clear demand for baseload power. And I accept nuclear, and especially large nuclear, is not for everybody. But that's where small nuclear is different. The economics of the SMR are different. If we take this graph here, it looks at levelized cost of energy. It's based in Australia, and it's based on a prediction in 2030. So SMRs are the green section to the right, and we're looking at various scenarios we've been looking at within Rolls-Royce there. On the left-hand side, you've got the red section, which is coal, the purple's gas, and then there's a band of kind of renewables to the right of the gas generation. David Jarvis raised a very interesting point about shale. Shale is a big threat, and SMRs are not immune to that threat. Part of the reason this is done across Australia data is because of the variation in gas prices. If you look at, I think in 2012, the kind of the cheapest gas price in the US got down to almost $2 per million BTUs. Compare that to Japan, that was $18 per million. So a factor of 9 difference in the price of gas. So to draw this actually levelized cost of energy against the US, the gas would probably come out a lot cheaper. But the other thing is overnight cost of capital. The overnight cost of capital, if you believe what the vendors are saying for small reactors, we're talking about $500 million $500 million as opposed to $5 to $6 billion for a larger station. The manufacturing lead times are a lot shorter, so we're talking 18 months to 24 months build time as opposed to 5 or 6 years of build time. So this is all coming out with a levelized cost of energy in dollars of about $4,000 per megawatt. But the SMR has a bigger potential market than just the standard energy generation market. because of its size, it's got what we're terming in Rolls Royce as the application-driven market. So it's looking at additional uses outside this kind of gigawatt plus power additions, and I'll just break that down. So we've talked about the idea of baseload power generation, top left, the replacement of retiring fuel coal and oil and gas stations on the right. So these application markets are more to do with captive power. So the idea of having an SMR localised, privately owned, and generating power for, let's say, a large industrial application, so manufacturing plants, smelting plants, things like that. It's also got rural and remote communities don't need gigawatts of power. They only need megawatts of power. You've got essential services such as government facilities, military, desalination, hospitals again. And then, last but not least, on the right, bottom right, the idea of not everybody needs megawatts of growth and not everybody's infrastructure can support gigawatts additions. There's a 9% rule for when you're adding power into existing power grids. And then the other issue is the finance. You know, finding the money to actually buy these things is quite a challenge, especially for the large nuclear. So, what further cost reductions can we do beyond what's already been talked about for SMRs? And let's just talk about the engineering for a bit. It's just mapping the applications over those. So, engineering can provide solutions to bring the cost down even further from what the current manufacturers are saying for SMRs through increased automation, inspection and manufacturing, the read across of improved manufacturing methods from the aerospace industries. We think we can reduce the manufacturing times between 10 and 80% and the actual cost of manufacturing down between 10 and 60%. And then also, since the 1960s, when we were last designing reactors in the UK, there's been a significant improvement in materials understanding, coatings and things like that. So, it's currently... we've done cost analysis on some of the US design SMRs within Rolls-Royce, and we've concluded from those that there's a potential to reduce the cost further by about $50 to $100 million. So that's quite a substantial reduction on what's already there. But the problem we've got is it's currently uneconomical for vendors to invest in the technology due to the small production volumes. So we're coming back to this issue of economies of scale versus economies of volume. If we can't secure the volume of sales, then we can't get the investment into the SMR market. So there's two things there. There's the idea of securing volume, which could be assisted through clear government messages and the idea of contracting at a kind of global level for reactors, or the idea of internal country funding to help the investors and companies invest in a small reactor. So the question is, can a small reactor become like a catalyst for this kind of investment? If the volume can be secured, then non-conformance can be driven down through statistical control, because these things are going to be made in factories and shipped out as complete units. We can then lower the unit price because we've got flow production methods rather than individual production one-offs. Again, the smaller size of the units makes itself applicable to better and already proven technologies within the manufacturing industry. We can increase competitiveness, and we can, by reducing the competitiveness, increase the volume of future business, basically creating this virtuous circle. So, how do we go about doing this? Well, the governments and countries with the nuclear pedigrees need to start supporting industry within the countries to help secure jobs and technologies. And this is going on. The DOE in America has got the FOA out on small reactors, which just went through round two, I think. Probably phase two of round one would probably be a more accurate description, looking at the funding for SMRs within the US. We've got UK Biz is supporting various projects within the UK. Specifically, I'm thinking probably of the Sheffield, the NMRC, the Nuclear Advanced Manufacturing Research Facility. So money is coming in to help develop this. And the money's needed because the UK needs to develop the advanced technology and own the intellectual property. Either that or provide a design authority role. If we just become a supplier to the trade, then the UK won't really benefit. The benefit is going to come from our kind of our advanced technology and usages. So John Adams put up a good slide yesterday, which showed that the decline in nuclear research down from 9,000 people down to a current level of about 500 people. But it's not just the engineering. The total cost of nuclear ownership is horrific. If you're a new player in a nuclear, if you're a new player, so you want to develop nuclear within your country, to get the kind of IAEA's fit for purpose, fit for nuclear, it's a 10 to 15 year programme and it's hundreds of billions of pounds, and that's before you've even started building a power plant. So nuclear infrastructure, the reactors and vendors, the engineering construction and the finance all need to work together to try and drive down the cost of nuclear. Yesterday we talked a lot about security and proliferation. Well, it's just an open question to the floor. I don't expect an answer now, but is the idea of a turnkey nuclear solution actually possible in today's climate? Again, David Jarvis earlier mentioned the Atoms for Peace and the West building reactors in Pakistan. Today, could that actually happen? Do we feel that that is an option? Could nuclear industry club together and offer a solution to a country to build, operate, fuel for life, do all the maintenance, and even decommission it at the end of life? And I ask this because the kind of second round, this is all kind of, at the moment, the first round of SMRs is looking at the kind of light water technology. But the nuclear battery, I mean, would that ever work? Could it work in the way we're set up globally at the moment? So I've only got two more slides, so I'll leave you with that thought, and we can talk about it in the questions later if we want. So the global obstacles for generating fleets of SMRs, and that's what we need. We need lots of similar designs out there because we don't want to be managing individual plants. We need to be managing fleets of these things with commonalities between all. So engineering needs to kind of pull together global standards, reducing the variation and complexity and cost in the actual designs. The vendors need to start sharing more information, the service data, intelligent monitoring, predictive maintenance and things like that. And some of that happens. We've got EPRI, we've got 1.0, so things have moved forward in the last 10, 15 years on that front. Same with regulation, governance and inspection. Regulators in the Middle East, you've got the Arab Atomic Energy Agency now, you've got the European Nuclear Safety Regulations Group. In Asia, you've got the Asian Nuclear Safety Network, and then you've got the IAEA, who's providing the governance kind of around all of that. Without global or regional kind of coordination, SMRs aren't going to be viable. If you have to license every SMR in every country you want to deploy it out to, it's just not going to work as a model. Yeah. And then last, but by no means least, the politics and governments. Without clear energy policy, at least at a kind of local or regional level, ideally at a global level, it's going to be very difficult to do anything with the SMR. The simplicity of licensing and planning needs to be addressed. You know, this idea of providing a turnkey solution, is it feasible in today's climate? And then, last but not least, on the old government side, the actual idea of financial backing and support for nuclear. So bringing it, concluding with the UK. For the UK to be benefited from SMRs, it needs to be the forefront of nuclear design and manufacturing innovation. We can't be a bit supplier into the trade. It won't work for the UK. It won't generate the jobs we need. It won't generate the income we deserve. And to achieve this, the nuclear industry needs a clear message of support from the government. Basically, to allow new designs and technologies to be developed, provide the jobs and growth within the industry we all desperately need, and to return the UK back to a leader within the nuclear industry. Basically, we mustn't be caught napping. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm getting a cold, so excuse me if my voice starts going. So my name's Howard Wilson. I'm from the University of York. I was originally tasked to talk about some of the major plasma physics-based challenges associated with fusion. I don't want to give the impression that there are a lot of them, but there's certainly more than I can do in 10 minutes. So I noticed that the sort of the theme of the session was going along the size of along the lines of, can we make power units smaller? And so what I thought I would do is look at some of the issues that determine the size of a fusion power plant, how we could, in principle, try and make it smaller, what's the plasma physics that stops us making it smaller, and also some of the benefits of going smaller. And they're not just financial. They would actually make fusion easier to achieve if we can go smaller. So this is what I'm going to talk about. I'll illustrate, it's plasma turbulence, which is at the root of the size of a fusion power plant. It's what's driven us to the size that we're at now. It's what's driven ITER to the size it's at now. And I'll illustrate that. I'll show you that it is possible to quench the turbulence, and if we can quench the turbulence, we can make a smaller power plant. This does happen. We don't understand why it happens. If we can understand why it happens, then we can make it more ubiquitous. So I'll show you that. I'll then look at some of the issues of plasma physics that have that impact on the materials, because I'm guessing that there are probably more material scientists in here than there are plasma scientists in here. So I thought I'd look at some of the issues where the plasma and the materials come together. Martin mentioned handling the exhaust, so I'll look at some of the problems of handling the exhaust power out of a fusion power plant. Plasma eruptions, which are like little baby solar flares going off inside the tokamak all the time, has big implications for the materials you use. And disruptions, which is like a big old thing going off. I'll close with something about materials choices. So there's quite a lot to get through, so I'm going to go quite quickly and just give you a flavour. So this is MAST, inside MAST now. Martin showed you it outside. So you've got the copper centre column there, which is sort of lump of copper about that diameter, and maybe a metre and a half high to give you the sense of the scale. And all those striations there that you're seeing in that picture, that's an actual visually enhanced picture of MAST. That is the turbulence inside the tokamak. And there are simulations that I'm showing on the left here of that turbulence. So one thing you see is you see the same sort of striation. The color codings, if you can think of them as density perturbations, or you can think of them as the way that the particles stream along the field line. So those striations basically follow the magnetic field lines that's holding that plasma together. And if you look at the cross-section, let me move away from the microphone. If you look at the cross-section here, you'll see these very small eddies, basically. So you think about particles going along constant colours. These things are basically turbulence eddies, and the size of that eddy determines the diffusion process. This is just another still of it in case the video didn't work for whatever reason. And it's that turbulence that leads to an excessive loss of heat and means we can't get the conditions inside the hot, inside the fusion plasma, inside the plasma to make fusion to occur in a small device. It means we have to go to a large device. However, this turbulence can be suppressed, and I can show this with this video. I'm not sure. Is it possible to turn the lights down, do we know? Because it's... I think the video will show up a lot better with the lights down. So at the moment, this looks fuzzy, and that fuzziness is the turbulence. It's lots of little tiny plasma filaments being thrown off all the time. And I'm going to set the video going, and it won't. I'll tell you what happens first, because it happens quite quickly. But you'll see that fuzziness disappear, and it goes really sharp. And that's the turbulence switching off right at the edge of the just right at the edge of the plasma. So if I set the video going. So you'll see those little wispy filaments, they're the turbulence, and then they're all gone, okay? And that's quenched the turbulence. It turns out that you only see it at the edge of the plasma, because it's just where the plasma interacts with neutral atoms around it that you see anything visual. But nevertheless, it is quenching the turbulence. This is called the H mode for high confinement. And if you go in and you look inside it, so this was just comparing the low confinement mode, the turbulent mode, to low confinement because the heat and the particles aren't so well confined, with the high confinement mode where we don't have the turbulence and suppressed it, but that turbulence is just suppressed right at the edge. And the reason we know it's just suppressed right at the edge is if I plot, I'm going to plot in a minute, the temperature or the pressure going from the hot core of the fusion plasma here out towards the edge, okay? So I'm just going to show you some plots going from here through to the edge. And this shows it for the two kinds of mode, as we call it. The turbulent mode, the low confinement one, shown here, so-called L mode, L for low, and then this reduced turbulence state called the H mode, the high confinement mode. And if you look carefully at these profiles, it's just looking at pressure as a function from the hot core out towards the edge. If you look carefully, you'll see that it's just at the edge. You've got this really high pressure gradient region. And so what's happened is that the plasma somehow has made for itself an insulating region right at the edge of the tokamak. It's just like you put a big insulating jacket around it. And that's raised this whole the whole pressure inside to a high level. Now, if we could understand that, so on this is jet now, I should say, this profile here on that I'm showing here is from a jet plasma. But this region where we've suppressed the turbulence is maybe about that size in jet compared to a plasma that's like a meter across. Now, if we could understand why the plasma has made that, what we call a transport barrier, that big and make it go to that big, you can see the kind of pressures that we can start building up. And pressure is good. High pressure gives you fusion power. Okay, you've got to get to a certain pressure, then your fusion power will switch on. So if we could make that so-called transport barrier go further in, you can see that suppose we were, for the sake of arguments, trying to get to a pressure of 30. So on jet, we need something that's about a meter across. Okay, if we could get that transport barrier to go further in, you'd need something that was maybe 30 centimeters across. So you're starting to get to a smaller device. So if we can learn how to suppress that turbulence, we can go smaller. Now, we know something about it. It's been known for 30 years this happens. And what we think plays a role, so I can go back to this video again now, is flows in the plasma. And we think what happens is the strong flows in the plasma tear those eddies apart. So when this goes back out again, we're not really interested in these long filamentary structures. When this goes back out again, you'll see that this part of the plasma is rotating this way, this part of the plasma is rotating that way, and it's tearing apart those turbulent eddies, making them narrower, and therefore reducing the turbulence, reducing the step size of the diffusive process that's leading to the loss of heat and particles. So we think flows play a role. Where the flows come from, we don't have a full understanding of that yet. So if we could suppress the turbulence, then we can go to a smaller device. Smaller devices are obviously good for the reasons we've just heard about, just generically good, not just good for fusion. But actually, it helps fusion in another way. One of the big challenges with fusion is handling the power, the exhaust power. And the reason it's difficult is illustrated again by looking at mass. So here I'm showing the different parts of the, if I can get the cursor up, I'm showing the different parts of the plasma. So we're piling, at the moment we're piling heat into here to bring it up to the fusion conditions. One day we hope the fusion power itself will pile the heat into here and bring it up to the fusion conditions. That heat diffuses out towards the edge through the turbulence process that I've just described till it gets to this bright region around the edge. And this bright region is basically the exhaust pipe of the tokamak. Okay, it's a magnetic exhaust pipe. It's made from magnetic fields. We call it the scrape-off layer. And that region takes those heat and particles, once they get to the edge, and it takes them, in the case of mast, down to the bottom and up to the top. And down at the bottom and the top, there are what we call target plates, lumps of metal, basically, or carbon, in case of mast. And that takes the heat out in this region called the diverter. So all of that power that we're putting in here ends up in a ring, hitting these target plates down at the bottom of here in this diverter region. That ring scales like the area, or the lengths, if you take a length scale L, for example, that area that we're putting the power onto scales like the length squared. The amount of heating that you have to provide scales like the volume or the length cubed. So if we go to smaller power units, the amount of power heat that we have to handle, the power unit area we have to handle, goes down significantly as we go to the smaller devices. And as Martin said, one of the biggest challenges that we have with fusion power at the moment, building demo the size it is how do we handle that power? So if we could suppress the turbulence, could go to a smaller device, smaller fusion device, then it'll help that power handling problem. I was talking there about the steady state power handling problems, and I deliberately, this is going to be the same video, and I deliberately stopped it early after it went in this so-called H mode, because it goes into you start to see a different sort of phenomena if I'd kept it going. Now, these are the plasma eruptions that I referred to. They're called ELMs, or edge localized mode, so it's gone into its H mode, it's built those steep pressure gradients, and then bang. It doesn't like those steep pressure gradients. It's like you've blown your balloon up too much, and it keeps popping. It recovers in these situations, but each one of these throws out a huge amount of energy, particles and heat. And for ITER, that is a major issue. ITER cannot handle at the moment the ELMs, these eruptions, as predicted now, at full performance. Okay, so we have to figure out a way of controlling these things. This shows a still of them, again en masse, and you'll see it's not a uniform shell that blows off, which is what we thought it was until about 7 or 8 years ago. It's actually filamentary structures, and this is what I said, it's like little solar flares that are coming out of the surface of the plasma. And they may or may not be the same physics. For the purpose of this talk, we don't care. Sometimes I do care. But nevertheless, these things could do quite a bit of damage, and I say are a major concern for ITER. With this in mind, we're trying to figure out how to control them. And one way to control them was pioneered on a tokamak called D3D in the US, in San Diego. And what they're doing is they're putting little coils inside the tokamak. Basically, what's happened is your confinement's got too good at the edge. You've suppressed all that turbulence right at the edge. Pressure gradients have built up too far, and it's popping. So what you want to do is reduce those pressure gradients back down again at the edge. And the way they're doing that is to put some coils inside the tokamak vessel here. So think of this as like a Terry's chocolate orange building up. And this is one of the segments of your Terry's chocolate orange that go around to make the toroidal chamber. And inside, they're putting these coils. And by putting currents through those coils, you basically make the magnetic field at the edge of the plasma, a little bit fuzzy, and it degrades the confinement, reduces the pressure gradient back down again, and switches off the ELMs, these eruptions. So to show that, this just shows think of it as the amount of light that's emitted as a function of time. Early on, there's a moderate amount, and this is the turbulence, those wispy filaments I showed you early on, moderate amount of light emitted, goes into this H mode very, very rapidly, and that's again an interesting piece of plasma physics that Martin thinks is solved, goes into a what we call the high confinement mode that I showed you, low light emitted because there's no turbulence now, and then bang, 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 these are all the eruptions. Now we switch on that coil current, those eruptions switch off, and they stay off until you switch the coil current back off again, and then they come back on again. So all that looked good, and ITER is designed to have these coils in them, but it doesn't always work. You'll know that when you have a superconductor, you can't get magnetic field into a superconductor, or you can freeze it in. A plasma is a very, very good conductor, but it's not a solid body. It wriggles and writhes and squirms. So when you try and push magnetic field into a plasma, it does all sorts of tricky stuff that we don't fully understand yet. So it looks like it will work, but we don't understand all the details of it yet. The ELMs, these eruptions, the plasma does recover from them. They're an issue because they will degrade the material surfaces. But there are some bigger events that terminate the discharge. And these are called disruptions, and it's basically where you lose control of the plasma. And so this is a disruption on mast, and you'll see it start to wriggle a little bit down here. Then you lose control over it, and it shoots off into the top of the vessel. Now, that was a pretty hot plasma that's just gone up there. It was also a plasma that had about a megamp of current through it, and you've got a magnetic field of about half a Tesla. You can go and ask your second-year undergraduates what sort of forces you get from a megamp of current flowing through something that's sort of a meterish big and a field of around a Tesla, and you get forces like 1,000,000 newtons, and enough to lift a jumbo jet, basically. So there are big thermal forces, and this colours the infrared images resulting from that disruption as it goes flying off into the top. And that thermal load is an issue, but the biggest issue are these forces, because these forces, every time you make the thing bigger, if I double the size of the machine, I've doubled the length goes into this force. I have to double the current to confine the plasma. I have to double the field to confine the plasma. So doubling the size of the machine makes these forces go up by nearly a factor of 10. ITER is twice the size of JET, and these forces are already pretty big on JET. So if we can make the machine smaller, these are less of an issue. ITER is designed to handle some of them, nevertheless, but not too many. So we need a way of handling it. One way of handling it is to send. So you notice though that little rippling of the surface. You don't always get a warning, but usually you get some warning that this thing's going to happen. And one of the things that we've looked at on mass, and other tokamaks have looked at this as well, is whether by puffing gas in, so this is gas coming into the tokamak. The tokamak's in the center of the picture. You'll see it in a minute when it starts radiating the light. You puff gas. When you sense it's going to go into one of these disruptions, you puff gas into the thing. That irradiates lots of energy quickly, cools the plasma down, so you don't have the big thermal loads. As the plasma gets cool, it gets more resistive, so you dissipate the currents, so you don't get the big electromagnetic forces as well. And JET already uses this to mitigate some of its biggest disruptions. And what you'll also see is the plasma didn't fly up into the top or the bottom. It just went out nice and gently. So I've talked a little bit about some of the loads that you get you can get in tokamak situations. So these are the kind of loads that we're going to expect in ITER or power plant scale thing. So the eruption, so this is, So the along the bottom here is the time scale. This is the kind of heat flux. So you get big disruptions, high heat flux, short levels. The diverter, the exhaust system, is sitting down down here, but has to survive for a long time. So this raises the issues of what materials choices do we use for these. And the materials that we need, just in a cartoon sense, have to handle a high heat flux from the plasma. You need some sort of coolant, way of cooling the thing, taking that heat away behind it. And the question is, what material do you put up against the plasma between that coolant substrate and the plasma itself? It's got to have high conductivity to get the heat through it into the coolant thing, and it's got to be able to handle the high handle high temperatures. And until now, as Martin was saying, it's largely been carbon. But when Jet did his experiments with tritium at the end of the 90s, it found that what happened is the carbon was eroded, went up into the plasma, went round the vessel, and then rested in the vessel somewhere. And as it rested down on the vessel, it trapped the tritium fuel. And you can't have that. You can't have that situation. It just traps too much tritium. So the community has moved away now to metals, and in particular, ITER. This isn't ITER, this is JET, but JET is designed to look like ITER now inside, in terms of materials anyway. ITER will have beryllium and these plasma-facing components here. Okay, it has to be a low-charge material, because otherwise it would get into plasma and radiate too much. And then down at the bottom, where we have to handle the high heat fluxes associated with the exhaust, it will have tungsten. Okay, so I'll leave it there, because I noticed that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone. We've got a hard deadline of 1 o'clock for lunch. It was proposed to have the same structure for discussion where you huddled around your tables for about 5 minutes, then we went straight to questions. But I'm just wondering whether we should go straight into questions from the floor. I'm looking at the conference organisers to get a steer from this. Yeah, okay, right. So okay, we'll get your brain cells working. We'll give you just about a little bit less than 5 minutes just to have a quick chat around the tables, let the speakers gather at the front table, and then we'll go into questions, okay? Thank you very much. Okay. The speakers are, the panel's gathering. I can hear there's plenty of buzz around the table. I mean, say some of the things which were going through my head for the talk. So some things like, you know, what does the UK need to do to maintain its position with nuclear fusion? What can nuclear fusion learn from some of the lessons we've learned in fission? And also, what can next generation fission, which hasn't been talked about today, learn from the large fusion international program? So some of the thoughts that are going through me. And also, Andrew's comments about whether a turnkey nuclear solution is possible in the current climate. But over to the floor. Who'd like to ask some questions of the panel, please? Peter?
Just in terms of...
You're not here for speaking, yeah.
Peter Fleur at University of Bristol. In terms of the small modular reactor, the key challenge will be regulation, presumably.
How do you envisage it being operated? Do you see that you as a supplier would actually effectively provide power by the hour and therefore would operate or provide all the support, including the continuing update on regulation?
Yes and no, as you would expect. I don't think there's going to be one model which works everywhere. For a start, you've got to look at the fact that there's quite a few SMRs being developed across various parts of the world. I mean, predominantly from a Rolls-Royce perspective, we're really looking at US manufactured SMRs. We're not on about developing our own. So we're on about partnering with somebody else. Putting in the advanced manufacturing, and yes, we see the after sales market is like we've done with our aero division and doing power by the hour as a way of successfully running that as a business model.
But would that cover the regulation How do you overcome that?
I don't think that solution exists, and I think part of that is because the way how regulation works across the globe, as we are at the moment, and without taking a global approach to regulation, it's going to be very, very difficult for SMRs to do that. I think the best we're going to get in the next 10, 15, 20 years is probably some kind of like regional level, but even that's no way, you know, at the moment you could argue that's probably not really on the cards at the moment either. So you are going to have that huge regulatory cost every time you want to put one of these plants into a new location, into a new country. And you're right, that will that preclude the use of SMRs? It might. It's a big issue.
Okay.
So I have two questions, one purely for the fusion side and one for the small modular reactor side. So in terms of the materials needed for fusion, I mean, going in, there's the amount needed for deuterium and lithium, helium as coolant for as well. Are there any, in terms of sustainability issues, in terms of actually getting those materials out? So say lithium, you have competition with other fields which would use that, and also in terms of deuterium, if you're having to generate heavy water, or if you're having to generate other materials, are there potential concerns in terms of dual use materials, things along those lines? And in terms of small modular reactors, there are a number of designs. As you mentioned, there are a number of designs for various technologies. Most of the arguments in terms of the economics comes through to when you get to the next of a kind plant. So then the question goes to how do you have that transition from first of a kind to next of a kind? Will it require 10 reactors or 100 reactors? How would you actually be able to get those learning rates, getting the learning rate such that you do end up with an economic solution?
Shall I answer the first
Please.
Bit? The amount of fuel that a fusion uses is very small, tiny. So deuterium is utterly negligible. It's very easy for them to see, etc. Lithium, of course, you know, it's under a lot of demand for batteries and things. But there's lithium in the sea. There's no issue there. The amount of lithium you'd use up is pretty small. This does bring me on to one thing that none of us mentioned, but it relates, well, it relates a lot to Howard in particular, the fact that fusion is so capital intensive, but not in lithium or anything like that. It's very capital intensive up front. And that's, we're well aware that at the moment that doesn't make it attractive. And that's why going to other smaller ways, either through the physics or the technology, is something that I think we've got to deliver, because ITER is pretty expensive. Who's going to build, unless you're China, who's going to build a demonstration power station that's presumably going to be more expensive than ITER? We've got to find ways of making it simpler and more efficient. So, but on the fuels and deuterium and lithium, that is not an issue at all.
Okay, coming back to the small reactor side then of that question. You're completely right. I mean, at the end of the day, the first of the kind, look at nuclear history, the chance of building a first SMR to budget is pretty remote, let's be honest about it, as is the first of any kind of nuclear thing we do is pretty always goes over budget and draws out. So it's going to come down to two things, I think. And one is going to be the belief in the market and the economics of the people who are designing these things. And to be honest, we're quite sceptical about some of the numbers which are coming out of some of the potential vendors globally, not just in the States. And then it's going to be down to whether or not. So, I think the proof will be in the pudding of the building of the first one, how much that overruns, how much that costs, and then whether or not we can actually invest in a facility to actually drive these costs down in the subsequent units. And that will come down to whether or not we've got some kind of guaranteed volume of sales. And you're right, without that kind of guaranteed volume of sales, then putting that investment in is going to be a too big a book for any one company to deal with. So it's an issue.
I actually have a question for the panel as a whole, really. From what I've heard today, it seems like there are kind of three solutions to a very growing energy problem. You have large-scale fission, small-scale fission, and potentially even fusion into the future. But each one of these systems is competing for a limited amount of not only financial resources, but just policy-making apparatus. And I'd like to get a feel as to the panel's opinion on the government's overall kind of energy strategy on this. Is it joined up in any way? And I'll give you two kind of potential scenarios in this. One might be that, let's say, small modular reactors become a feasible solution over the next 40 years. Does that mean that the government's strategy towards small-scale tokamaks has become redundant? Does that disappear? If the government's nuclear, large-scale nuclear strategy comes to fruition over the next 40, 50 years, does that also mean that small modular reactor is put by the wayside? The second example would be, if you're looking for regional cooperation or regional coordination on these type of things, particularly for regulation for small modular reactors, I imagine each country has their own pet toy that they want to be able to sell on that market. And how would that actually work? Is the government's energy strategy looking beyond Britain's shores to really try and get a more holistic approach to it? And finally, if one of these technologies were to fall by the wayside because we're only looking at the energy problem, are we wasting a lot of money? Because I understand that the difference between inertial confinement fusion in America and magnetic confinement fusion here, there's a large difference in funding. In America, there's huge military interest in it, obviously, because you're investigating the behavior of nuclear weapons in the very, very initial stages of an explosion. Is there any exploration of a military application towards magnetic confinement fusion if the energy side of it doesn't seem to be relevant anymore? So generally, does it seem like the government's taking a holistic picture over these technologies, or is it simply focusing on which is the next big thing to solve the energy crisis?
Over to you.
Well, I'm not sure I'd like to answer for the government in any of this. But firstly, I don't think you should, in any area, especially as one as important as energy, you shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. So you should expect some things to fall by the wayside. And that doesn't, not a reason for trying to, there's no way you can pick in advance the winner and just go for that. It's a very risky strategy. What else? I think where you came in about, you know, government policy, etc. If you compare how much goes into nuclear energy research, firstly, I think nuclear energy, because of some of the reasons Andrew's talked about, etc., there has to be a lot of governmental investment in it, that you can't leave it to the market. It's just because it's so because of the long-term aspects, the capital-intensive aspects, etc. I think if you look back at how fission was originally developed, obviously there was a military imperative, etc. But the amounts of money you looked, in the 50s or whatever, compared with now, you know, it dwarfs it by orders of magnitude. And, you know, we had this graph from John Adam yesterday about the workforce, and it's similar on the investment in research. I think, you know, personally, I think the government policy, at least it's going in the right direction, but the differential is very small. It's got to really ramp up on the research for all sorts of reasons, not just the actual development of systems, but for the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. That, my own view, and I probably shouldn't say this as a government-owned organisation, but I will, is it's still too little, and the derivative, as I say, is still too small. On inertial versus magnetic, you are right that, you know, the inertial research, a lot of this has a military sort of imperative, and that's why the investment's been made. I think if we come to your question, that there isn't the military sort of applications of the magnetic area at all. We're too way away from the bomb. The inertial fusion is still a long way away from the bomb, but it's at least some of the codes, etc., are in common, and that's why doing those experiments is a very good substitute for actually letting something off. So, but we in magnetic fusion are way away from that, and there are none of those issues, and it makes it easier to get people, etc., etc. So, that's my take on it.
Yeah, perhaps I can pick up on that. I think it is really a serious duty of government to keep the options open. Particularly in the energy area, where it's really not at all clear what big changes may happen in the next 20 years. You know, in the last 20 years, we've seen the rise of global warming as a dominant issue in energy policy from more or less nothing. We've also seen Fukushima and the impact that has had in some countries, fortunately not in the UK. So government has to keep options open, and that has to be, I think, from a strong research base. But from my personal perspective, I think it's also important that the private sector is engaged in the innovation process around research and new technologies. I think that adds a vital part to the mix and plays to a UK strength, which is the entrepreneurial innovative spirit. On the point of magnetic versus inertial fusion and the relations to weapons, I mean, one of the big reason why ITER happened is because it was the one thing that Gorbachev and Reagan could agree on to collaborate on in 1985, and they set that in motion at the time.
I'll just pick up on the ITER issue. The UK, through the EU partners, invested a lot of money in ITER. And one of the things that we have to make sure that we do is we fully exploit ITER. The people who gain the experience of running ITER and doing experiments on ITER are the ones that will then go on and design a demonstration fusion power plant. So in the short term, we need to make sure, speak as a university person, that we train enough people to fully exploit ITER. And in particular, the UK is in a unique position, and it's the only nation, only country at the moment that is operating an international tokamak facility, a nuclear international tokamak facility through JET. Now, JET will likely close down as ITER starts up, and the UK must not lose that expertise. It's very important that expertise is used for developing systems for ITER, but also maybe getting jobs on ITER themselves, so that we keep that capability and keep the option open into the future. On the inertial versus magnetic fusion, it's not a US-UK split. The US happens to have a big facility. We also have big facilities in the UK, not at the same level, but Aldermaston and AWE, for example, have the Orion laser facility, which is it's up there. So it's not a US-UK balance. Tokamaks just don't have the energy densities to be able to get anything like weapons applications.
Just a dead quick one from the SMR point of view. Could fission compete with fusion? Hopefully, yes. I don't see that as a bad thing. And as the gentleman on the far left said, from an energy policy point of view, you've got to keep all your options open at the moment. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you. One at the back. Yeah? Sorry.
Morning, Jeremy Edwards, UK National Nuclear Laboratory. Just picking up on UK policy and strategy, the government, Department of Biz and Department of Energy and Climate Change this morning have just announced and released a suite of documents on this issue, which includes the UK strategy, the R&D that will be required to underpin the options going forward, which include potentially a significant element of nuclear contributing to UK energy going out to 2050. There's various things in there, including a Nuclear Innovation Advisory Board. There's a separate industrial vision and industrial strategy. And the work that was referred to earlier in terms of a nuclear user facility also forms part of that and complements the Jules Horowitz investment that was announced, I think, about a week ago. By Department of Energy and Climate Change. So the current debate, very, very timely. There's a lot happening. There's an awful lot of documents have been released today that really sort of set out the future for the UK. Rather unfortunate, I guess, that they weren't released yesterday and we could have been talking about probably the details.
George, yeah.
I've certainly become very enthusiastic about small fusion reactors in the last couple of years and have been working with David Kingham on some of the materials aspects. But what I would like to ask the panel is two policy areas which affect fission. One is the regulatory environment and the other is the disposal issue. It does seem to me that if you're comparing fission and fusion reactors, then a lot of the cost for fission reactors is back-end loaded. It's what you do with the stuff at the end of lifetime. And it's not clear to me that the fusion is anything like so heavily back-end loaded. The other question is which is linked to this at the front end, is at the moment we don't seem to have an identifiable separate regulatory framework for fusion. But can you see a framework emerging, which, for example, might be considerably lighter touch than it is in the fission case, in which case, in terms of commercial competitiveness, fusion would look more attractive than fission.
Yeah, I think the answer to both those points is yes. On the waste from fusion, although the volumes might be comparable, there are none of the high level and the actinides, etc. So after that's the whole point of designing one of the points of designing the materials or using the choice of materials for fusion is you pick low activation materials or ones that decay quickly. So the disposal problem on fusion is on a sort of 100-year time scale, you just leave it or whatever, and then it's largely benign, etc. You don't have any of these long-term fission issues. So certainly on that, that is one of fusion's advantages. The other aspect was the regulatory climate, and there hasn't been one developed for fusion because, as I said, there's only two machines that have ever ran with tritium, other than now in inertial fusion, maybe in America. So there hasn't been the need for that climate. There will have to be probably better controls and monitoring, etc., of tritium inventories. But again, if the fusion was used for nefarious purposes, the neutrons for developing bomb material or whatever, you're not looking for a needle in a haystack. You're looking for you don't have that problem. So that is another advantage for fusion, that the regulatory thing should hopefully be lighter and much easier to impose. Having said that, of course, like any industry, like chemical industry or whatever, fusion will have to have its, it's an adaptive, bespoke sort of regulatory environment. But to be honest, we're not there yet, and it's not foreseen to be an enormous problem.
Okay. Can I just follow up on that quickly? One other point is as Martin said, that the neutrons associated with fusion are very high energy neutrons, and a lot of the materials are not qualified in a high energy neutron environment. This may or may not come back to bite fusion at some stage. The fact that we don't have a test reactor type thing for qualifying materials, and the the strategy at the moment is to qualify the materials on small-scale accelerator-based systems. And a question will be, at some time, is that sufficient?
Thank you.